Women MPs can't expect to receive rape threats, death threats, threats to their children. The leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, Jo Swinson, and a number of other female MPs have had to go to the police because their young school-aged children have been threatened with death. And this is a democracy, and it makes it very, very difficult for democracy to operate if women are scared of fulfilling their democratic function and their duty. We've also had physical acts. We've had guns taped to the outsides of MPs' offices, bits of animal being delivered, powder arriving through the post. And what's particularly troubling about this current atmosphere is that it seems almost to have been sanctioned from the top. And that's not to say that it has been deliberately sanctioned, but the Prime Minister, when women MPs raised the issue of the threats they were receiving and their fears that some of those who were making the threats were serious, the Prime Minister dismissed their fears as humbug.
I'm your host, Michelle King, and you're listening to The Fix, a podcast that shares the stories of women and men who are innovating and taking action to advance equality in the workplace and beyond. As most of you probably know, the United Kingdom is going to be having a general election on Thursday, the 12th of December, 2019. The vote comes amid continuing uncertainty over Brexit. A snap election is seen as a way to potentially break the deadlock between political parties over the divisive departure from the European Union. But what some of you might not know is that an alarming number of women members of parliament are standing down at the upcoming general election because of the unrelenting online and in-person abuse they face in public office. In fact, a total of 18 women are leaving. While this is roughly proportional to the current makeup of parliament, expectations are that the number of women leaving should be a lot lower because these women are not following a normal choice to retire like most of the 41 men who are leaving. Female members of parliament are effectively choosing to retire early, and the reasons for this include a hostile work environment, abuse, and discrimination. What is so fascinating about this for academics like me is that I'm often confronted with the argument that to solve inequality, we just have to hire more women and increase the representation to around 30%, which research often suggests is the tipping point for changing work environments. But this makes absolutely no sense. Workplaces don't magically change because we've achieved an arbitrary target. Why 30%? Why not 60%? Do we have numbers for every minority group? What about white men? Do we have numbers for them? You can have 30% of women in an organization, but still have a workplace culture that marginalizes, discriminates, harasses, bullies, and excludes women. You can't put a number on equality because it's something that people experience. If you're going to measure anything, measure the culture. Survey, interview, observe people's behaviours, because this is where inequality happens. The UK Parliament is evidence of this. Currently, there are 206 women in the House of Commons. This is an all-time high at 32%. However, the instances of marginalisation, discrimination, and harassment are at an all-time high. So much so that the very women we've managed to advance into these positions are now leaving. And this really matters. Women's participation in politics helps advance gender equality and affects both the range of policy issues that get considered and the types of solutions that are proposed. Research indicates that whether a legislator is male or female has a distinct impact on their policy priorities. So on this episode, you'll hear from Jennifer Nadel, a qualified barrister, author, speaker, campaigner, and award-winning journalist. Jennifer is also the co-founder of Compassion in Politics, an organization that aims to advance compassionate politics and a caring society. On this episode, Jennifer will unpack how women leaders are systematically bullied, drawing on the UK as an example, and share what all of us can do to fix it.
Just before 1 o'clock today, Joe Cox, MP for Batley and Spenborough, was attacked in Market Street, Birstall. I am now very sad to have to report that she has died as a result of her injuries.
On Thursday, the 16th of June, 2016, Joe Cox was fatally shot and stabbed outside a library in West Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. According to eyewitnesses, she was shot 3 times and stabbed multiple times. Initial reports indicated that the attacker, a 52-year-old man, had a history of psychiatric problems and links to the US-based neo-Nazi group, the National Alliance. He shouted "Britain First" as he carried out the attack. The far-right Britain First Party issued a statement denying any involvement. Joe Cox died shortly after the incident from her injuries. This is the real cost of everyday bullying, harassment, marginalization, and discrimination that women political leaders come to tolerate, accept, and eventually expect. Despite the increased representation of women members of parliament in Britain, the current levels of abuse have become so unbearable that 18 women are stepping down. Here, Jennifer Nadel explains the issue facing women in politics today in the United Kingdom.
We're facing an unprecedented situation in the UK at the moment where female parliamentarians are being subjected to threats, intimidation, and in some cases, physical acts. And that is having a dramatic effect on the retention of women in politics, in particular, moderate women. And we've just had a string of women saying that they're not going to stand again in the upcoming election, which is very disappointing because Parliament needs experienced women sitting there and helping in the decision-making process. And a lot of our experienced women are not coming back. Women MPs can expect to receive rape threats, death threats, threats to their children. The leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, Jo Swinson, and a number of other female MPs have had to go to the police because their young school-aged children have been threatened with death. And this is a democracy, and it makes it very, very difficult for democracy to operate if women are scared of fulfilling their democratic function and their duty. We've also had physical acts. We've had guns taped to the outsides of MPs' offices, bits of animal being delivered, powder arriving through the post. And what's particularly troubling about this current atmosphere is that it seems almost to have been sanctioned from the top. And that's not to say that it has been deliberately sanctioned, but the Prime Minister, when women MPs raised the issue of the threats they were receiving and their fears that some of those who were making the threats were serious, the Prime Minister dismissed their fears as humbug. And that was really a turning point, because to have the Prime Minister say that women being scared of being killed because of their parliamentary office was nonsense, when in the UK we have had a female MP, Jo Cox, who was murdered in those circumstances, felt as if it was a green light. It gave a green light to all sorts of hate and intimidation to continue.
In the United Kingdom, the number of recorded hate crimes has more than doubled in the past 5 years. According to the Home Office, this increase is in part related to the aftermath of the Brexit vote and the rise of terrorist attacks. Jennifer says this rise in hate crimes has also coincided with the rise in verbal and online abuse of women members of parliament.
Since the referendum in 2016, there has been an unprecedented rise in hate crimes of all kinds. Anti-Semitism has risen, Islamophobia has risen, and misogynistic attacks have also risen. Something has been unleashed in Britain that has not been seen, certainly in my lifetime. And it's really scary. It feels as if those voices that people may have felt obliged to constrain before the referendum have somehow found space and a legitimacy. Of course, it's not helped by the internet and the fact that anyone can say anything online and that it often takes a long time to get those offensive and threatening tweets taken off. But it obviously is a criminal offence when it gets to that stage, so one can involve the authorities. So it's less about those specific threats that can be investigated by the authorities and more about a general atmosphere where it suddenly feels safer to talk in abusive ways that would not have been tolerated previously. I've been working in or around the British Parliament for 30 years, and I have never seen abuse at this level. When I first started as a junior correspondent for the BBC working in Parliament in the late 80s, women were denigrated, they were sexualized, they were dismissed in very chauvinistic ways, but no one threatened them. They're now threatened with death, and it's a really, really significant worsening of the state of affairs. And back in the late 80s, we only had 42 female members of Parliament. And we always thought that when we got more women running for public office and being elected, the situation would get better. In 2017, we had 208 women elected to Parliament, but that wasn't enough to solve the problem. And the problem has, in fact, got worse. And that's because the problem isn't women and the number of women. The problem is the culture, misogyny, the environment in which women are expected to work in politics, and the legitimization of hate and really unpleasant attitudes that has happened post the referendum.
In the United Kingdom, a new movement to stop abuse in politics has recently been launched, known as the hashtag Stop the Nastiness campaign. The initiative calls on all candidates to take a stand against toxic politics by pledging to campaign with respect, call out hateful language, and promote compassion. Members of Parliament from across the political spectrum have backed the campaign. Here, Jennifer shares why this initiative is so important.
There have been two reports recently, one in the House of Commons and one in the House of Lords, looking at the levels of abuse that women experience, but no recommendations have been enacted. And while those cogs are turning very slowly, the abuse is escalating, continuing, particularly now that we have a general election happening on the 12th of December. So the Stop the Nastiness campaign is an intervention right now to say that all of us have got to stop it. You know, if we spoke in the way politicians speak to each other in our schools or in our colleges or in our places of work or in our churches or other organisations, they would simply not be tolerated. And yes, somehow in the political sphere, the abnormal has become completely normalised, and we tolerate ways of interacting that are simply not okay. And it's up to all of us as individuals to say, we don't want you behaving like that. So the Stop the Nastiness campaign gives voters a chance to tell all the candidates standing in their area that they would like them to sign up to an anti-bullying code of conduct. It's astonishing that there is no anti-bullying code of conduct in the House of Commons. And that, again, gives an implicit green light to the sort of interactions that we've seen. Unfortunately, the abuse is not just online, although that's where the most egregious threats and abuse takes place. Articles are left, signs are posted, visits are made, and I've spoken to women MPs who are really genuinely fearful for their own safety and the safety of their children. And that is very dangerous to our democratic process. One female MP I spoke to said that she had other colleagues who couldn't vote according to their conscience because they were so frightened of what the consequences would be, particularly on issues relating to Brexit. So if we're trying to operate a democracy where the politicians who are meant to be enacting that democracy are actually too scared for their own physical and their family's physical well-being to express their views, we have a really serious situation here. And one of the reasons why the Stop the Nastiness campaign has taken off is because nothing has been done.
While bullying and harassment negatively impact all women, it disproportionately impacts women of colour. Diane Abbott is a Labour Member of Parliament who in the 2017 general election received over half of all the online abuse. This included both racist and sexist comments directed at female politicians, according to an Amnesty International study. This example highlights how abuse disproportionately affects Black, Asian, and minority ethnic women, who are more likely to experience multiple levels of discrimination. Black and Asian female members of Parliament receive 35% more abusive tweets than their white colleagues. This acts as a further barrier to women's political participation.
Women of colour are in the most difficult place of all because they don't just receive threats based on their gender. It is also based on their race. And you're right, Diane Abbott at the last election got 45% of all abusive tweets were directed at her. And that's because she's a powerful woman. She stands on the left. Her views are well known. She's been in politics for a long time. She's not someone that it's easy to sexualize because she doesn't objectify herself. And that doesn't go down well with that sector of the British public that are unfortunately increasingly feeling able to express their misogyny and their racism. We only had 9% of the UK Parliament as Black or Asian women. And those women receive a disproportionate amount of the abuse. They get 35% more abuse than their white colleagues. So race is clearly a really big issue, as is gender.
Nobody should have to tolerate death threats, aggressive emails, being shouted at in the street, harassed on social media, having to take extra measures to protect themselves and their family because of their job. According to a CNN report, British female politicians say they've received an unprecedented number of threatening messages since the UK's vote to leave the European Union in 2016. Here, Jennifer explains what has led to this complete loss of basic decency in politics, where members of parliament think it's okay to treat each other in a way that they wouldn't anyone else.
Well, there are two issues. The first is the way in which the House of Commons, which is, you know, an ancient building and follows many ancient traditions, conducts itself. The House is laid out on two green benches, which are two swords width apart, because when it was originally built, parliamentarians carried swords and could well end up in a fight. So they deliberately placed these two benches. And that, although no one carries swords, thankfully, anymore, that adversarial, very pugilistic atmosphere continues. People boo, people shout, people mock, people shame. It is an absolutely extraordinary environment in which to try and govern the country. And for anyone who comes from a country where parliamentary business is conducted as it would be in any other setting, it is absolutely shocking. And talking, as I do, to new women MPs when they enter parliament, they are all utterly shocked at what they're expected to tolerate as part of their normal work. So this is before we even get to the level of gendered and racist abuse. This is just considered normal, that you mock and jeer at your opponents. It's like being in a bar or at a football game. It's really difficult to think of this as the mother of all parliaments, and yet it is. So part of the problem is that it's institutionalized. An adversarial, rough, aggressive way of speaking is actually enshrined in the procedure. That's one half of the problem. And then the other half of the problem is that the culture has shifted in this country. Things are now said openly that would never have been said before. Women are now targeted in ways that they wouldn't have been targeted before. And it's as if hate has been legitimized in some way by the outcome of the referendum. And that's not just hate for immigrants or people who have differences. It's also hate for women, particularly in positions of power.
For Jennifer, the word compassion is meant to describe having a concern for other people and, when required and appropriate, wanting to do something to help them. The aim of her organization, Compassion in Politics, is to put compassion back on the political agenda, which will make it possible for leaders, politicians, and policymakers to talk about compassion without appearing weak or soft. Here, Jennifer shares why this is so critical.
Compassion in Politics was set up because it was clear to many of us working in the political field in the UK that compassion had been systematically edged out of politics and was no longer seen as a legitimate political driver. And actually, the best moments in this nation's history and in most nations' histories is when they have been at their most compassionate, when the British accepted 10,000 Jewish children at the outbreak of the Second World War, when America came to Europe's defence and acted with compassion again in the face of Hitler. Those moments of compassion really tell us who we are as a nation, and yet they're gradually being erased. And in fact, many of those single issues that many of us care so deeply about, whether it's refugees drowning at sea, whether it's hunger, whether it's the abuse of minorities and of women, all of them are linked by a lack of compassion. So compassion in politics aims to put more compassion both into policy, but also into the way politics is conducted, because if you're in a pugilistic adversarial environment, you're very unlikely to arrive at compassionate policies which really do aim to protect the most vulnerable in society, which is one of the main reasons that we have government, in my view. Parliament wasn't designed around having women or people of colour there. It was a white male institution. And we thought that by simply electing more women, and particularly women of colour, that would naturally change the culture. But the culture is strong and it's archaic and it is much clung by those who benefit from it. So if we want change, we have to change the way we're doing things. In terms of leadership, it's not that we don't have leadership. We do have leadership, but we have the wrong kind of leadership. We have leaders who have prospered in this atmosphere of rhetoric and point scoring, and are very, very good at that. But those aren't the leaders that are actually going to lead to reforming our politics so that we can find common ground, so that we can build consensus, so that we can be inclusive, which is exactly what we need at this divided moment.
Is it really possible to bring compassion back into politics? A lot of people might question the authenticity of politicians suddenly demonstrating compassion. Here, Jennifer shares an example of when and how leaders can get this right.
We have seen examples recently in the world of what compassionate leadership looks like. Think of Jacinda Ardern after the horrible atrocity in New Zealand and how her response came straight from the heart. It wasn't calculated. It wasn't about where the gain was from her party. It wasn't about damage limitation. It came straight from the heart. And voters really respond to that. We're not stupid. We know what's real and what's authentic, and we would like to see more of that in our politicians. We do a lot of polling here in the UK, and voters consistently say that they would switch their party loyalty, which is very unusual in the UK, they would switch their party loyalty to back a leader who was more compassionate. The problem is that we don't have very much of that on offer. We have Caroline Lucas here, who's our sole Green MP, and she's definitely seen as compassionate, and we have some other more junior female MPs who are seen like that. But the British system is so tough that it doesn't reward and advance those who operate in that compassionate, authentic, emotionally connected, self-aware way. So we would love to have our own Jacinda here in the UK, and we desperately need it.
Finally, Jennifer shares how each of us can take action and bring compassion back into politics.
Well, we would love everyone's support for Compassion in Politics, and in particular the Stop the Nastiness campaign. If you live in the UK, you can find our tool online and email your local candidates in the election and tell them you'd like them to stop the nastiness and sign up to the anti-bullying pledge. But more generally, you can show your support for Compassion in Politics by signing up to our work. And also, if you spot abuse online, you don't need to engage with it, but do use the Stop the Nastiness hashtag. Abuse isn't acceptable wherever it happens. We don't need to engage with it, but we do need to call it out. So anyone who feels safe enough to do that, use that hashtag, and let's have a united response to say we're not prepared to see these levels of abuse and hate escalate.
The impact of our words is often overlooked, but when it comes to hostile workplace cultures, racist, sexist, homophobic words are all indicators of a general tolerance for intolerance. When we look away, pretend we don't hear, laugh at a derogatory joke, or say nothing, we sanction these behaviors. Speaking up and calling the behavior out, or asking people to explain why their jokes are funny, or why they think their comments are acceptable, are all strategies that we can use to tackle inequality at work. Importantly, people in dominant positions in organizations, which tend to be white men, are better placed to do this work. Being in the majority often affords you the privilege of being able to tackle inequality that you may never have to experience. I encourage everyone to speak up because, as evidenced in the United Kingdom, the stakes are extremely high, not only for our democracy, but for the lives of the women political leaders who serve us. Thank you so much for tuning into our episode today. If you're interested in partnering with us or being a guest on the show, then please reach out through our website, thefixpodcast.org. You can also sign up to our weekly newsletter and contribute your story there. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll catch you all again next week.